Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with protests at Wisconsin's Capitol in Madison over the shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a white policeman on a day that Governor Scott Walker signs a contentious bill he championed into law that makes Wisconsin the 25th right-to-work state in the U.S. John Nichols, the nation's Washington correspondent and co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, joins us from Madison to discuss the shooting of 19-year-old Tony Robinson Jr. and the fourth day of protests at the Capitol from mostly high school and college students angry at yet another police shooting, as well as the significance of Governor Walker's union-busting victory to his 2016 presidential run in a crowded field of Republican presidential candidates. Then we'll examine the unprecedented interference by 47 Republican senators who sent an open letter to the Iranian leadership in an attempt to scuttle the ongoing negotiations between President Obama and Iran's supreme leader at a critical stage in the P5+1 efforts to reach a deal with Iran to curb its nuclear program. Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, joins us to discuss this latest attempt to sabotage Obama's foreign policy and the unusual coalition of Republican senators and Iran's hardline religious leaders that Obama mocked. Then finally, we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and speak with David Smaldi, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has researched Venezuela for the past 22 years and lived there for 12 years. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and we will discuss today's announcement from the White House that Venezuela is a threat to America's national security, which is clearly ridiculous hyperbole from Obama, who appears to be throwing a bone to Senator Marco Rubio and the anti-Castro crowd. But in effect, this will prove to be a gift to Venezuela's embattled President Maduro, who blames all of his country's problems on the Yankee imperialists. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And his latest book, co-authored with Robert McChesney, is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
Ian, it is good to be with you on this island of sanity.
Well, I regret to say that Madison, which has always been an island of sanity, particularly a very liberal community, and, in a sense, they're surrounding a capital led by Governor Scott Walker, who is very much out of step with the citizens of his own city, the capital city. I noticed that my daughter lives there, so I've been there and noticed that almost every bumper sticker says, "Recall Walker." So he sort of lives in occupied territory, if you will, but somehow or other he's managed to make Wisconsin the 25th right-to-work state in the United States. How did he do it?
He sure has. I could give you a very long answer, but I think we can make it very simple. It's the change in the politics of America, and it is incredibly fundamental, but it's one to understand. It's not just Wisconsin went right-to-work. 2 years ago, Michigan, the home of the United Auto Workers, went right to work. A few years before, a little while before, Indiana went right to work. Indiana, home of, Gary and much of our steel industry. What we're seeing is the right to work movement, which we should never call right to work. It's a horrible phrase for what we're talking about here. We're really talking about barriers to organizing and collective bargaining that make it hard for unions to function in the workplace and in our public life. But this movement has spread very, very rapidly. Well, why so? It has spread because of two things that have happened, and that's what we read about in Dollarocracy. One, our traditional media, newspapers, radio, television, with their newsrooms, and even if they were very imperfect, their coverage of what was going on has declined dramatically. You can pick up a daily newspaper anywhere in America. It's going to be, minuscule compared to what it once was. TV newscasts are full of weather and sports and exercise tips, but very, very little news. Our mainstream news has dialed down, and the void has been filled because of Supreme Court rulings going back to Buckley v. Vallejo, Citizens United, a host of others, with a massive inflow of corporate and billionaire money, self-interested money, seeking to create a politics and to create a narrative in our society that says the problem is unions. The problem is organized workers seeking a fair day's pay. This has become very, very powerful in our politics, and the evidence of the power is not found in, you know, Mississippi or Alabama. It's found in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana. They're trying now in Illinois. They're trying in Michigan. They're talking about a right-to-work law in New Mexico, which is traditionally a very strong labor state. And what we need to understand is that none of this is coming from some outcry from citizens. There's no workers aren't saying, oh, we want weaker unions, we want less pay, we want less benefits. No, this is a top-down political pressure on our process, and the people that want this change are having a lot of success.
And the people that you're talking about who are doing this and who are being successful are the American Legislative Exchange Council, who are funded by big corporations and the Koch brothers.
Without a doubt. Yeah, it's not complicated stuff. I mean, the best way to understand it is that back in the late 60s, early 70s, when we really had opened up the political process in a lot of ways, and voting rights had real meaning. It wasn't just for African-Americans. We were breaking down barriers to Latinos, to Asian-Americans. People 18 to 21-year-old were starting to vote. And the interesting thing happened. Even when Republicans won, progressive policies won. So Richard Nixon comes in, and yet he accepts Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, creates the EPA, starts talking about expanding housing and maybe even a national health care plan. It was at that point that corporate money and billionaire money, wealthy people who either own corporations or made a lot from it, very clearly decided that they were going to create an infrastructure that included groups like ALEC, Heritage Foundation, right-wing media, and the goal of that infrastructure was going to be to shift, I would argue, warp the debate and shift, I would argue, warp our politics and shift, I would argue, warp our courts to such an extent that even though we had opened up our democracy, they could still win. And I think that's what we are starting to really see, the profound evidence of that at this point. And it's something we got to talk about a lot, and we have to really restructure a lot in how we think about things, because this is what we're up against. We are not up against, you know, traditional Republicans, traditional conservatives. In fact, when I talk to traditional Republicans, old school Republicans, by and large, they're horrified. They know that this isn't going to work, that this is terrible for the economy, that this is terrible for society, and that ultimately it's going to harm states and very probably the whole country. But we have created a politics in this country now that is exceptionally unhealthy, and we would lie to ourselves if we didn't acknowledge it.
And this bill that Governor Scott Walker, this right-to-work, so-called right-to-work bill that Governor Scott Walker signed today in Brown Deer, Wisconsin, at a factory, Badger Meter Incorporated, it was an invitation-only deal. It wasn't, so there weren't any representatives of labor. There were no working people there. There were, in fact, this is a factory owned by a millionaire campaign contributor of Governor Walker's, who had threatened to send jobs of Wisconsin workers overseas unless this legislation was passed. So, you know, I mean, what about the grassroots? I mean, this is a terrible, terrible barrier. It's going to be hard to undo. This is going to require activism. And I recall how when Governor Walker went after the state workers, there was a tremendous backlash. Was there simply exhaustion as a result of that and the failed effort to recall? I'm trying to understand how...
No, I respect what you're asking. It's a good question. Yeah. I think there is a measure of exhaustion and frustration and... a sense that that something was learned in the very optimistic days of 2011 and 2012, when you had mass protests and then you had the effort to recall the governor. And that is that, you know, unless you defeat these guys, they're not going to listen to you. There's not, you know, some sort of middle ground where if they are threatened by protests, if they feel the possibility of a political blowback, that they're going to change. That is not how this thing works. They are elected on a mission, and the people who paid for their election, the people who have driven this thing, are neither satisfied nor willing to accept less than what they seek. And so that sounds very draconian, but it's actually practical politics. The money power in America threatens to primary, to challenge in the primary, Republican elected officials who don't do what they want them to do. And so, as a result, I think what a lot of Wisconsinites in great frustration learned was that this is going to be really hard. And, you can tell yourself differently, but that's just simply reality. And I don't think that people have given up, but I think people have begun to look at very different strategies. There's a huge fight now for who the next chairman of the Democratic Party is going to be in Wisconsin, a lot of strategic questions there. There are unions that are really rethinking how they want to organize, what they want to do, what their strategies are. The Working Families Party, which has been very active in New York and Connecticut and other states out east, is coming into Wisconsin with all sorts of organizing strategies and new models for, taking it very much back to the grassroots and building something up. And the core of this thing, I wish I could make it complicated because it's a lot more fun when things are complicated, but it's actually pretty easy. The core of this thing is to get a great mass of people who have given up on voting to decide it actually might matter to go vote, and to get presidential-level turnouts in off-year elections, because that's what's happening in Wisconsin. Remember, in a presidential election, Wisconsin elects, it votes Democrat for president, elects liberal people to the U.S. Senate. In a non-presidential year, Wisconsin goes very right-wing. And so what you're really talking about here is not a change in the state, but a fundamental shift in the reality of our election cycles. And there are a lot of people taking that very seriously. And I don't, at the end of the day, I don't think Wisconsin is necessarily going to suffer or be worse off than most of the rest of the country. What I think is important is that the whole of the country ultimately understand that what's in play now is a great battle for our small d democratic life. And if we think it's just going to fall into place, as it did, historically in recent years a little bit, wrong. It's not. It's not going to just be election day, go vote for who you like. It runs a lot deeper. It's going to take immense amounts of organizing. It's going to take immense amounts of education. I think we're coming into a very difficult period, not an easy period. And I want to assure you, it isn't going to be solved, very unlikely it's going to be solved by the 2016 presidential race. I think it goes the opposite. Instead of going up that ladder to the presidency, I think it involves a lot of going down deep into the grassroots and organizing people around issues that they care about. And they're not just economic issues. They also involve social issues, issues of concern to young people, issues of concern to communities of color, which have frankly not been well addressed by our current politics.
Well, there's no question, John Nichols, that Karl Rove understands what you were talking about, these off-year elections.
Oh, yeah.
He, in 2010, he engineered, along with money from the American Petroleum Institute and all of the powerful corporations and oligarchs in this country, they engineered an amazing electoral victory, highly financed, caught the Democrats napping just 2 years after Obama swept into power. And it was very well planned, and it was on a census year, so they were able to essentially gerrymander the Congress now, where it's almost impossible for the Democrats to take back the House. Then they've done it in two subsequent elections, largely because the Democrats just don't show up at the polls. And I find that incomprehensible in the context of what we've just witnessed in Selma, Alabama, the 50th year of the march on Selma that was brutally put down, and the people there were marching for their voting rights, and President Johnson, with great political courage, signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, knowing that the Democratic Party would lose the South, but it was the right thing to do. People bled and died for the vote, and yet young people today, and African Americans at that, simply aren't voting in the ways that they should be, and it's incomprehensible to me. What's your explanation for it?
I think you got to give people a politics. I understand everything you're saying. I respect it. And I do think a lot of political leaders pull their hair out over this. And I think this is, frankly, a lot of what President Obama was speaking about in his speech in Selma, which to my mind was one of the best speeches he ever gave. But with all due respect to all of these, noble notions, at the end of the day, politics has to give you a sense that you're going to get something. And I don't mean, personal gain per se, but that some goal, some value of yours is going to be realized. And one of the things that money does to politics is it dumbs it down, it makes it incredibly negative, and it shaves the edges off. It doesn't make it scary or passionate or real as regards what you want in an affirmative way. It may be scary because of what's said about somebody else. But at the end of the day, the fact is that Democratic politics in America, even what we think of often as progressive politics in America, has not spoken well or boldly to what people need and what people want. You know, look, Ian, we have huge problems in this country with, structural unemployment in communities of color, structural unemployment among young people especially, structural challenges as regards policing that are overwhelming and deeply meaningful to a lot of people. And yet our politics, we don't fight races for public office about that very often. We tend to have campaigns that are very soft, and they're aimed at a tiny number of people who supposedly are somewhere in between the Democratic and Republican Party, like they're going to switch back and forth. No. To have a meaningful politics, you have to go out and talk to the people who aren't voting because they just don't think it matters, and you cannot say to them, it does matter. That's not enough. You have to say to them, here's why it will matter. Here's what's real here. And the interesting thing is that our Republican friends have gotten much better at that. They do speak to their core constituencies. And so let me give you an example. In 2008, Barack Obama is elected president of the United States with strong majorities in the House and the Senate. He had campaigned with overwhelming and passionate support from the trade union movement in this country. What the trade union movement wanted was EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, make it a little easier to organize. They didn't get it. 2010, Republicans campaign. They go to their corporate donors. They go to their billionaire allies. They say, if you elect us, we're really going to go after labor. Right? What did they do? They got elected. What did they do? They did what they said they were going to do. They went after labor. You know, at some fundamental level, Republicans reward their friends. Republicans make their elections meaningful, right? It matters when they win. And people can see that, people who are aligned with them. And people who, and this isn't just about the billionaire class. This is also about, working class people who happen to be passionately concerned about, reproductive rights, people who are against abortion, people who are, against gun controls. The Republicans, when they get in, they reward those people. They give them policy changes that they value. When Democrats get in, they manage. They, by and large, they get to power, and they manage what they're handed, rather than thinking about, okay, we won, we have a mandate, what do the people who gave us our mandate need? And so that break in our politics is where we lose tens of millions of voters. And I don't mean we as in some party or something like that. It's where our process loses tens of millions of voters. And you're not going to get progressive politics as long as that continues.
So, John Nichols, let's turn to the other issue that's happening in Madison, Wisconsin, and that is the big demonstrations. There's been 4 days of demonstrations since the shooting of the 19-year-old unarmed young black man, Tony Robinson, by a white policeman in Madison. This has led to 4 days of protest, and on Monday, about 1,500 high school and college students showed up at the Capitol in Madison, holding up signs saying Black Lives Matter. We're familiar with that because of the Ferguson and the other shootings around this country. What is the latest on that? Because it does seem as though there is, the policeman himself apparently had been involved in a 2007 shooting, but also the victim himself had pled guilty last year to charges of armed robbery. So what clarification can you give us on this shooting?
A little bit, perhaps, on how to think about these things. First off, when these two people got into that room, in that very brief period, about 20 seconds, it sounds like a very brief period of some sort of clash and firing, they didn't know about, either of their background that I know of. So I don't think we should worry too much about, what somebody did unless we've got a pattern, something that tells us that there's a real pattern. I don't know that that's the case. What I know is that a young African-American man is dead, and he was unarmed. And this is something that has a tremendous amount of meaning in our society because we have seen it happen so many times in so many circumstances. In Madison, which is a pretty liberal town, I think people had liked to imagine, they had told themselves that they had evolved their police force to such a point where things like this were very unlikely, almost, you know, they almost, you could bet it wasn't going to happen. But it did happen. And what these young people are saying is that they are not satisfied just being told, well, yeah, but this is a good place, and, you know, it's better than other places and stuff like that. They're saying, look, you know, look, if we're better than other places, if we're maybe more progressive in some ways, then, you know, figure out how to deal with these things and do a better job of it. Does that mean that there's never, ever going to be a situation where, you know, there's clashes between a police officer and an individual where even a gun might be involved? No, that's not. We're not going to get to probably that perfect place. But the fact of the matter is, for this to happen, it demands a response. It demands seriousness and investigation. Now, Wisconsin happens to be very lucky in one regard. This is a kind of a remarkable thing. A year ago, after some other incidents, police shootings, one in Madison, one down in the town of Kenosha, or city of Kenosha, a couple in Milwaukee, the state of Wisconsin passed a law that took responsibility for investigating officer-involved deaths, the case of somebody who dies when an officer is either pursuing them or has them in custody. Officer-involved deaths are not investigated by the police force involved. They are investigated by a independent state agency, the Department of Criminal Investigation. I cannot emphasize to you how important that small shift has been. That does not solve all the problems. It doesn't even begin to address a lot of fundamental concerns. But what's happened in Madison is that the police chief was able to announce immediately, this investigation is not going to be handled by this department. You know, we're not going to lead this investigation. This is going to be led by outside folks who are professionals and looking at things like this. And it's very, very interesting because we've had a lot of protests in Madison over the last four days, but they have been very disciplined, very focused. They've been talking about real reforms to the police. They have been expressing anger and passion, but it has been very disciplined and focused. And I think part of that is that, you know, people are willing, they're frustrated, and I'm not saying that they're completely happy, but there's a willingness to, you know, have this investigation process play out and a hope that it will provide some real answers. And I would say that the one lesson I would take away is that every state in this country ought to set up an independent review law, an independent review system for police-involved deaths, for police-involved shootings. Because I'm seeing right now in Madison that it doesn't restore all trust or build all confidence or make everything perfect. It's not that, but it provides a little bit of ground for dialogue, for conversation, for people to, it gives a little space. And you asked me what I have to report. What I have to report is today thousands of young people walked out of their schools, their high schools, their junior highs, kids I've known all my life, and they marched to the Capitol. They filled that Capitol with chants of Black Lives Matter and demands that that this city do everything in its power to figure out what happened and also to figure out what we can do to make sure that when two people get in a room again, forget all the history on all sides, when they get into that room, one of them's a police officer with a gun, and one of them is an unarmed young person, that they can somehow have strategies that don't lead to a death.
Well, indeed, particularly when the victim, Tony Robinson, suffered from attention deficit disorder, and the original dispatcher talked about a black male yelling and jumping in front of cars. He was identified on the 911 audio tape as Tony Robinson, and shortly thereafter, the dispatcher said, apparently Tony hit one of his friends, no weapons seen. There's a lot to be investigated here, obviously.
So much. And
I thank you, John. I'm afraid we've run out of time.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate being on with you very much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And his latest book, co-authored with Robert McChesney, is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the unprecedented interference by 47 Republican senators in Obama's foreign policy.
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me.
And President Obama has derided this open letter sent by 47 Republican senators to Iran. He's accusing the U.S. senators of interfering with the ongoing nuclear talks. This is a pretty extraordinary event, isn't it, that Republican senators in the opposition would send a letter to the Iranians and basically say the deal that Obama's negotiating with you is no good and we'll scuttle it the minute he's out of office.
It's unprecedented. It's quite shocking, to be completely frank, but it's also indicative of their sense of desperation. They have come to the conclusion that they cannot stop President Obama from striking this deal with Iran over the nuclear issue that would essentially put an end to this 20-year-old confrontation. So what they're left with is to try to intimidate the Iranians to fear agreeing to this deal by showing that Congress is so irrational and is so irresponsible and beholden to special interests, so that the Iranians will simply think it's not worthwhile striking a deal with Obama because Congress will not uphold and respect it. I don't think they will succeed, however. The initial reactions from Iran have been quite clear that they are, I think, realize that this is an act of desperation from the Republican side.
Well, President Obama went on to say that these 47 Republican senators made an unusual coalition with Iran's hardline religious leaders. And to me, that points to a certain symbiosis there that has always been apparent to me, and particularly Netanyahu and the hardliners. They're both feeding into each other's narrative, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's been quite obvious to a lot of folks that have followed this closely, but I think the reason why the president feels comfortable putting those words in his mouth is because now it's plain to see for everyone that hardliners in Iran, those who are the most anti-American, actually have a common cause now with the Republican Party and the Israelis when it comes to preventing this deal from taking place. The one interesting difference, however, is that the hardliners in Iran have been put in check, and they're not in a position, at least it doesn't appear so right now, to derail this deal, whereas at a minimum, the Republicans still believe that they can derail this deal, if not now, once Obama has left office.
But Dr. Tridipasi, when you say that the hardliners in Iran have been put in check, still the ultimate hardliner, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, still has to sign off on this deal. He's the ultimate arbiter, isn't he?
He certainly is, and there's not a likelihood of having a deal without him. However, so far, he has signed off of everything. He has agreed to much of the advances in the negotiations that have been achieved thus far, whereas the folks in Congress have been trying to stop these negotiations from the outset. So they've tried really hard, and they have undermined the president's position. The president would be in a much stronger negotiating position if the Iranian, if Congress at the same time was in support of what the president was doing. But by undermining it, he actually weakens the president's negotiating position.
Well, Iran's foreign minister has responded to this letter from the 47 Republican senators to the Iranians, basically saying that the deal with Obama, they're going to scuttle this at their first opportunity, obviously intending to scuttle this deal and do what they can. They already invited Prime Minister Netanyahu to essentially use the platform of the United States Congress to do electioneering for him for his re-election, at the same time condemning this deal. So they're really pulling out all the stops. But given that the Iranian foreign minister responds by dismissing the letter as a propaganda ploy, is it possible that the Republicans, senators, and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel are actually helping this deal by basically motivating the Iranians to make the deal because they are so irrationally opposed to it?
Unintentionally, Netanyahu has not only brought the Democrats closer together with the president, he's also created a situation in which the president and the Iranians are also more motivated, as you mentioned, to strike a deal because they see the alternative. It's not, however, an intentional strategy. It's not because this is some sort of a clever good cop, bad cop. Netanyahu's intent from the outset has been to derail these talks. And in fact, all of his talk of war also had an unintended effect, which was that he was talking about war and he wanted the U.S. to take military action. He certainly didn't want to see diplomacy. But all of his talk of war actually convinced the president that the only way to stop the Israelis from taking military action was to start a diplomatic process. A diplomatic process was the biggest and strongest buffer against any unilateral Israeli strike. So we've now seen a pattern in which Netanyahu's overreach and over-aggressive policies have actually achieved the opposite of what he was intending.
Well, apparently they haven't really made any difference in Israel itself, given that it was such naked electioneering on his part 2 weeks before the Israeli elections. And the speech that he made was extremely bombastic, but very, very weak on substance. So it did feel more like a campaign speech than a national speech on Israel's national policies. So
And timing the speech at 11 a.m. Washington time makes very little sense over here, but it makes perfect sense in Israel because that's the time when everyone in Israel is having dinner. So it seems to have been timed to have maximum impact in Israel, not in the United States.
But it hasn't had much of an impact, from what I understand, from the polls in Israel.
It hasn't had, exactly. His intention was to do that, but he's not had much of an impact. In fact, Netanyahu's numbers appear to be down. And in Washington, The visit as a whole could not have been more disastrous for Netanyahu. We've never seen a single member of Congress, to the best of my knowledge, boycott the Israeli Prime Minister's address to Congress. But 58 of them did so when Netanyahu spoke last, which is an indication of how much damage he's done to the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
So are we in an alternative universe? Because much of the press coverage that I've been reading has talked about what an extraordinary moment it was. And I saw a piece by Dennis Ross, the former Clinton administration and Obama administration Middle East advisor, albeit he's often been described as Israel's lawyer. But nevertheless, he wrote a very stinging rebuke of Obama and a praise for Netanyahu recently as well. So is this what's going on here, that people see things very differently, certainly than I do?
I would say that you know, Netanyahu's visit was disastrous from his perspective because so many of the taboos were broken. The amount of criticism Israel, Israeli policies, Israeli Prime Minister received from commentators, pundits, members of Congress was unprecedented, and he achieved nothing. There's no element in the negotiations that changed as a result of his visit. All he managed to do is to turn this issue into a more partisan issue, which made the Democrats more galvanized in standing by their president.
So, in other words, this letter then by the Republican 47 Republican senators is in a continuum of the Netanyahu attempt, and now, and I guess at the end of the day, you think it's going to fail because of the desperation that appears to be surrounding it.
I think it will fail to achieve its intent, but what I think it will end up doing is will make it more and more difficult for any Democrat to side with the Republicans and vote for sanctions and try to scuttle the deal. Secondly, 2 years from now, the Democrats can use this as a very potent argument. If there is a deal, and if the deal is successful and is being implemented, the Democrats in the next elections can say, well, if you vote for the Republicans, they have already on paper promised that they will undo this deal and bring us to another war. Now they have the Republicans putting their signature on paper that that's what they would do. And I think that's going to come back and bite them quite hard in the next election.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Tridipasi, the Congress, though, being in Republican hands, will surely, if there is a deal, the Republicans will surely not sign on to any agreement to end the sanctions, which will clearly be a part of the deal. So they still have some leverage over Obama. But my understanding is that that again will shoot America in the foot because the P5 plus one are really making this deal. And so that will mean that China, Russia, France, and the UK and Germany will be able to trade with Iran, and the Americans won't be able to trade with Iran.
Certainly. So if there is a deal at some point, there's a likelihood that also these other American sanctions would be lifted. But in the beginning, it's primarily going to affect the trade that other countries can do with Iran because the U.S. sanctions and trade embargo is not going to be touched by the nuclear sanctions that will be lifted.
So in other words, the U.S., this pent-up energy inside Iran to be accepted back into the world community to do business, because a lot of the reform comes from the young and the women and particularly the business community, the U.S. will not be able to benefit from a more open Iran.
No, on the contrary, I think they will, but it won't happen in the initial stage of this, because what they're negotiating about right now is the sanctions that have been imposed in the last 3 or so years that are nuclear-related. American sanctions go all the way back to 1994, 95, with a trade embargo that was imposed. And those are, to the best of my knowledge, not on the table right now, but they may be in the future once there first has been a deal and that deal has proven to be successful.
I thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who's a co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back and go to Caracas, Venezuela to talk about today's announcement from the White House that Venezuela is a threat to America's national security. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and also a professor of sociology at Tulane University. He has researched Venezuela for the past 22 years and has lived there for a total of 12 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. Professor Smildy moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thank you.
And I take it that things are getting pretty tense in Venezuela, not that they haven't been for some time, but now that the United States government has slapped sanctions on the Maduro government, citing an erosion of human rights guarantees and corruption, and President Obama has invoked his emergency powers to declare, quote, a national emergency with respect to the unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States posed by the situation in Venezuela. How is that being received in Venezuela?
Well, this is all very new. It's something that just happened in the past couple of hours. So the only reaction I've seen so far in the Venezuelan government is that they've recalled the charge d'affaires in Venezuela. Remember that there is no Venezuelan ambassador in Washington. They have a charge d'affaires, so they've recalled the charge d'affaires. But I think you can count on there being a pretty vociferous reaction to this. The sanctions were something that people knew were in process, but then the language of this, saying that Venezuelan is a threat to United States national security and invoking a national emergency with reference to Venezuela, I think it is pretty sort of alarming language, and I'm sure it's going to get a vigorous response from Venezuela.
And in terms of the officials in the Maduro government that are being sanctioned, Antonio José Benavides Torres, the commander of Venezuela's Bolivarian National Armed Forces, Justo José Noguera Pietri, president of Venezuelan Corporation of Guyana, Catherine Nayarith Harrington Padron, national-level prosecutor, Manuel Eduardo Perez Urdaneta, director of Venezuela's Bolivarian National Police, Manuel Gregorio Bernal Martinez, chief of the 31st Armored Brigade of Caracas, and Miguel Alcides Vivas Landino, inspector general of Venezuela's Bolivarian National Armed Forces. There seemed to be a focus on the military. Now, Maduro has led a lot of high-level military people into his government, hasn't he? He's lavished perks on the military, giving the Venezuelan armed forces their own television station and a bank, etc. So is that why these guys are targeted?
No, I think actually, if you look at it, you know, they named seven people, and they're all sort of mid-level people in the government. They're the people that are sort of the head of the different parts of the security apparatus. They're people in the armed forces, in the intelligence community, in the national police. None of these people are elected officials. There's no ministers. There's no vice president. There's nothing like that, which many of whom were on the sort of original list that Marco Rubio had circulated. So, what they're trying to do, what you can read from this list, is they're trying to focus on the idea of people who have repressed protests, in 2014. It's a focused list. It's only seven people instead of 20 or 30 that many of us thought it was going to be. And so in that sense, this rollout of these names seems to have been an attempt to not provoke the Venezuelan government. However, to actually roll out sanctions, to implement sanctions like this, the presidency has to declare this type of national emergency with reference to a country. Otherwise, he can't do it. And so this is something that's implicit in these sanctions and that was rolled out along with these sanctions. And that's what's really getting the attention. And that's what I'm sure the Venezuelan government is going to respond to.
So my understanding, though, is that since the Saudis essentially started to flood the oil market, dropping oil down to below $50 a barrel, of course, in the United States, we've seen gas prices rise because of speculation on Wall Street by the big banks, which is not being covered by the American press. But since Venezuela is not run by the five big Wall Street banks, I imagine the drop in oil prices being catastrophic for this government.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's really going on. No, there's a combination of failed economic policies, in Venezuela. No, already when Nicolas Maduro was elected almost 2 years ago, we were talking about the need for him to take urgent economic reforms. No, they have this wildly distorted foreign exchange regime. In other words, the Bolivar is wildly inflated. The dollar, the government sells the dollars it has in its reserves for approximately 5% of their actual worth. No, so you have these huge distortions in the economy. It's totally dependent on imports, and there's just not enough dollars to keep this economy going. At the same time, the government basically gives away gasoline, basically gives away electricity. No, it's an incredibly distorted economy, and that is just, we got to the point that is really causing very serious hardship for average Venezuela. It's really a crisis situation. So, you know, the government has its plate full trying to get its act together and trying to get things in order. In the midst of this, let me just back up and say, one of the things it tries to do is say, well, you know, these problems we're experiencing, it's not because of our failed policies, it's because of an economic war that's being carried out by the United States and by the people that support it here in this country. You know, it says that the United States has this all-encompassing economic, social, and political war. It's trying to sabotage this heroic revolutionary government led by Nicolas Maduro. So in the midst of this, the U.S. government puts forward these sanctions. Now it declares that Venezuela is a threat to national security. I mean, this appears to be made to order for the Maduro government. I mean, it could not, it's hard to imagine something that would fit better in this government's sort of theorization of what is going on in Venezuela. No, in that sense, I think it's very destructive because it allows the government to not put its house in order. It allows the government to not take the measures that it has to really fix the situation. It allows the government to distract attention. I think that's what's so damaging about these sanctions.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smildy, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela. He's also a professor of sociology at Tulane University, and he has researched Venezuela for the past 22 years and lived there for a total of 12 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. Professor Smildy moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and he is in Caracas, Venezuela. Now, so, David, it would seem, though, that, and I think it's amazing how wrong-footed the U.S. government can be. It's pretty breathtaking that they are playing right into Maduro's narrative here by this, you know, hyperbolic statement that Venezuela is a threat to American national security. That seems to be, though, the fact that Maduro is so heavily invested in anti-Americanism and blames the Americans for everything, and every other day there's another coup attempt that he talks about, without ever providing any evidence. This, of course, is going to play right into that narrative. But is Maduro trapped in the sense that he has to blame the Americans for everything, because he basically says, I'm not going to veer one iota from the legacy of Hugo Chavez? So he sort of constricted himself in terms of flexibility in dealing with the economic problems the country faces.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is trapped. I don't know if trapped is quite the right word. He's impeded. It's a very difficult situation for him. No, this is a classic case of what sociologists would call charismatic succession. No, it's always a problem when you have a very charismatic leader for there to be a successful successor. No, and so Nicolas Maduro was designated by Chavez. That's really all his one sort of claim to legitimacy is the fact that Chavez selected him to be his successor. No, Maduro was elected by a very small margin, has had a very difficult time, and he really just doesn't have the leadership strength to say, hey, you know, Chavez did this, we're now going to go our own way, in the way that, say, Michael Bloomberg did after Rudy Giuliani, or Juan Manuel Santos did after Álvaro Uribe. He just doesn't have that sort of leadership strength to make big changes. They are making changes. No, they're trying to make the exchange rate a little bit more flexible. They're talking about, they've started a conversation about raising the price of gas. They're trying to make changes, but at the same time, they're going to move on this front of saying that this is an international conspiracy, that's why things are so bad. And, you know, the thing is, this latter is much more successful so far for the Maduro government than the former. It's just very hard to put forward these reforms. And the more that they can do this, the more they can concentrate on this sort of mythical economic war and international conspiracy, the less they're going to concentrate on actually taking the actions that the country needs. So, yeah, Maduro is somewhat trapped. I think it's a difficult situation for this government. I think, you know, the U.S. government is playing right into, not so much just playing into their hands, but they're contributing to the more negative tendencies of this government. If they could just sit back and let the political situation play out and let regional actors and regional allies try to work with Venezuela, I think that would be much more effective.
So do you think that Obama has been pushed into this by the Republican right, by Senator Rubio, who of course represents or comes from Florida, but represents the right-wing, anti-Castro Cubans?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, this has, this was about a year in the making, about 9 months in the making. We started hearing about this about a year ago, and it took off in May or so, and then again in July. It was the sanctions bill was blocked in the Senate in August by Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, but then of course she lost her Senate bid and her Senate reelection bid. And really, the following week after she was replaced, this bill went through. Now, what happened in December was quite interesting because really throughout most of 2014. The Obama government, the State Department, tried to deflect this bill. They didn't really think it was a good idea either. They wanted to see that if UNASUR, the Union of Southern Nations, could actually do something with reference to Venezuela. But once this bill was passed by the Senate, and once the UNASUR mediation efforts last May had fallen apart, it became much more difficult for the Obama administration to resist this. And then we had the breakthrough, the normalization of relations with Cuba. And it was very interesting to see that, I think it was on the 15th, that the Obama administration said that they were going to normalize relations with Cuba. On the 16th, they signed this legislation for Venezuelan sanctions. Now, curiously, the most vociferous critics of normalization with Cuba, which are Marco Rubio, Robert Menendez, Eliana Ross Leteten, are the same people that sponsored the Venezuelan sanctions bill. So it's quite an artful triangulation, I think, on the part of the administration to really silence these critics. No, in fact, they only had about 18 hours to say that Obama was soft on dictators and had capitulated to tyranny and didn't care about human rights, because the next day they got their bill signed. So it kind of tongue-tied them for a while. I think, that's another big factor that was behind this legislation actually becoming law.
Well, but it just shows you how right-wingers who are so invested in their own rhetoric, their actions usually backfire. And as you've pointed out, it would be much more subtle and helpful to leave Venezuela alone and not provide Maduro with any, I mean, not that he needs any evidence, because he keeps saying the Americans behind everything. As far as I know, they're not really that active. They got their plate is full in the Middle East. But this plays right into their hands. And of course, Menendez is now up for indictment, for corruption.
Yeah, sure.
So they're such a tawdry bunch, these anti-Castro, anti-Venezuelan legislators here.
Talk about being impervious to evidence. I mean, these are the same people who think that 50 years of sanctions on Cuba worked. No, so I have no doubt that whatever happens, they're going to say that these sanctions on Venezuela are working just great as well. No, and so, I think being impervious to evidence is characteristic of politicians that are have a strong ideological and partisan line, and that's what we're seeing here. I think this has to do with political positioning. I think it has to do with meeting the demands of constituents. I think 90% of Americans don't really care much about what happens with or U.S. policy towards Venezuela. Most of them don't know where Venezuela is. But like anything, if you have a small group of people that care intensely about something and the rest of the great majority who don't really care much about it, they can usually get their way. And that's exactly what's happening here. Most people don't care about this. Few people care intensely and really push this.
But meanwhile, President Maduro of Venezuela, his approval rating in January stood at 22%. So he's really become incredibly unpopular since the drop in the price of oil. And but, you know, the interesting thing is, David Smiley, is of course that Venezuela is still one of the top five suppliers of foreign oil to the United States. Very few places in the world can process the oil that comes from Venezuela into the Gulf in Texas to the refineries there, which are the same refineries that also process the heavy crude from Canadian tar sands. So,
I mean, that's the irony of it, is that, I'm pretty sure the United States is still Venezuela's top commercial partner. And of course, it's the one nation that actually pays for Venezuelan oil in cash. And so they need, oil business with the United States more than the United States needs Venezuelan oil. And so that kind of keeps things from getting too bad, is commercial relations, But I think, we have seen that year after year, Venezuela exports less oil to the United States as it exports more and more to China, and the United States gets more and more from Canada and from fracking.
Well, but what's the relationship with China, though, in terms of, my understanding is that Maduro has been keeping his government alive by borrowing heavily from the Chinese and mortgaging the oil that's in the ground.
Yeah, well, that actually started with Chavez. In 2011, Chavez got the first $20 million or $20 billion of loans that are basically on oil futures. And so, yeah, that's another thing that is happening. I mean, even, what's going on right now, Venezuela still hasn't felt the full effect of the drop in oil prices. Oil receipts are usually about 6 months behind. And so, what's going on in Venezuela, I think, it goes beyond that. It's really a problem with the model. No, it's a model that's really been in decline since about 2011. Chavez kept it alive with loans from China. No, and Maduro has done the same thing, but they've gotten to the point where now they're starting to pay back these loans to China, and that lessens their oil receipts as well. And China's gotten to the point where they're not really willing to give out more loans. They're willing to invest some more, but they're not really willing to fork over as much cash as they used to. And so I think, what we're seeing is this model reaching an end.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today from Caracas, Venezuela, David Smiley.
Thank you for your interest.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smiley, who is a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela. He's also a professor of sociology at Tulane University, and he's researched Venezuela for the past 22 years and lived there for a total of 12 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. Professor Smiley moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.